Okay, so the questions I have in front of me is can you hear me okay? Yeah? Yeah. The first one reads, is it better to obtain the kammatthana before practicing meditation? How can a layperson meditating on his own obtain the kammatthana? I think, you know, these days there's so much information available on the internet, everywhere. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, we have the volume.
Yes, we are fine. We can hear you.
Okay. So I think there is so much information available on meditation on the internet, in many different places, in books, wherever you go. And often you don't actually need to have a special teacher to guide you or anything like that. You can use the information that is generally available. And of course, some of the most important information that is available is the information in the suttas. So it's wonderful to take things like the Anapanasati Sutta as one's guide, because that is the word of the Buddha. And the word of the Buddha is always the most profound understanding of what meditation practice is all about. And all other teachers, everything else you read, everything else you see on the internet, whatever it is, everything needs to be measured and compared to what is in the suttas. So the suttas is always like the fallback position, the final say on what meditation actually is. So that's why it is very useful to read things like the Anapanasati Sutta. And sometimes you will find it's difficult to understand all the aspects of the Anapanasati Sutta. And then again, you can go online and you can find some good explanations of that sutta, you know, from people like Ajahn Brahm, or maybe from somebody like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, or whoever you have faith and confidence in. And then you can guide you in that sense. So the other thing which is very important, sometimes it's also dangerous to rely too much on the teacher, because if you rely too much on the teacher, if the teacher doesn't understand you well, doesn't really appreciate what your problems are, what you should be doing, then it can actually sometimes lead you astray. So the best thing to do is to try to understand yourself, understand your own mind, understand what your defilements are, what your problems are. And by understanding yourself, you can actually guide yourself in the meditation practice very much. And one of the typical things that is problematic in our world, and I think this is everywhere, is certainly the case in the West, and that is the problem of too much anger and ill will. It's everywhere in society. You find it everywhere. And of course, the way to overcome that in the long run is the practice of metta meditation. So for many people, maybe the majority of people, it's good to do a little bit of metta, because it helps you to purify yourself, purify the defilements. And when you purify the defilements, that is when things like anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing, only becomes powerful when your mind is purified of the other defilements. So try that first of all, and then once you have tried the method that is in the suttas, the method that is given by people like Ajahn Brahm or whoever you have confidence and faith in, once you try that and you start to have problems, then you can approach the teacher, maybe via email. There's a forum on the Buddhist Society, for example. You may have a local monk in Sri Lanka who might be a good guide to you. Maybe Venerable Metta Vihari can help you out sometimes. Whoever it is, then you can approach. Once you reach obstacle somewhere where you can't really move forward anymore, that is a good time to ask somebody for guidance. But in the meantime, you can just use the information that is available everywhere else. There is a nice sutta, I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya somewhere, that talks about what time should a person go and see the teacher? What time should a person go and see the Buddha to ask questions? And the monks are arguing about this, and one monk says, oh, the best time is in the morning, because in the morning, you know, he's rested and he's ready to have a chat. Another one says, no, that's in the morning time is when they're getting ready for Pindabad. So that is not a good time. The good time is after Pindabad is finished. Then you should approach him, because then he's had his meal and he's ready to listen. A third monk says, no, that's not the right time, because then he's doing meditation practice. The right time is in the afternoon. And the fourth monk says, it's in the evening. And so they go on and on, discussing what the right time is. And eventually they go to the Buddha and they say, which one of us was right? And the Buddha said, well, actually the best time to go and visit somebody, to ask them about meditation, is none of those times. The best time is when you have an obstacle, when you have ill will, when you have like desire you can't get rid of, any of the five hindrances are overpowering your mind, that is the right time to go and see a teacher. And that is a very useful and very profound advice. It's when you have a problem, that is the right time to see a teacher. And apart from that, you can use the information that's available around to guide you in the meditation practice. So I think, apart from that, there are so many tools these days with the internet and everything. It is relatively easy now to get good advice on meditation, certainly compared to what it was maybe even just recently. Okay, so I hope that answers your question. I'll move on to the second one here. The second question says, is it absolutely necessary to attain the jhanas to become a sotapanna, a stream entry? And this is it's a good question. It's not clear, 100% clear in the suttas whether it is required or not. It's one of those things which is slightly grey and not really very clearly defined. What the suttas do say, and I think this is the most important thing, it says samadhi pachaya yata bhuta jnanadasana. Right? So samadhi is the condition for seeing things as they really are. Now if you think about what that actually means, we know that yata bhuta jnanadasana, seeing things as they actually are, it's stream entry certainly is seeing things as they actually are. The stream entry is included in that. Now samadhi, the word samadhi in the suttas, the main meaning of samadhi in the suttas is precisely the four jhanas. That's the main meaning here. And in certain cases, you don't see samadhi pachaya yata bhuta jnanadasana. You see sama samadhi pachaya yata bhuta jnanadasana. So it is, if you look at this in a kind of broader perspective, you can say that even though it may be impossible to be absolutely certain that jhana is required for stream entry, it is fairly clear from the way the suttas are phrased that even if it is absolutely necessary, it's a very useful and very powerful tool to get there. Depends on how you define, how you look at samadhi, whatever. But really the point is, and the point isn't, I think sometimes it's dangerous to discuss too much about whether you need jhana or you don't need jhana. Because the reason why people ask these questions in the first place is often because they want to decide, should I practice jhana or shouldn't I practice jhana, right? That is why you ask these questions. And if they decide jhana is not necessary, they will say, okay, let's not practice jhana then. And if they think it is necessary, they say, well, let's try to practice jhana. That is the wrong way of looking at it. Because what really leads to stream entry in the long run is the practice of the Eightfold Path. So what you do instead of thinking, do I need jhana? Don't I need jhana? What should I be doing? You just say to yourself, I will practice the Eightfold Path. That is what I will be doing. And what does that mean, practicing the Eightfold Path? Well, it means, among other things, that you have to go through the Satipatthana practices, which include things like Anapanasati. And if you keep practicing that path, then one of two things will happen. Either you become a stream entry. If you don't become a stream entry, you will have to continue practicing that path. And that path includes, of course, the jhanas, right? So instead of asking yourself the question, should I practice jhana or not? You just practice the Noble Eightfold Path. And that will eventually lead you to doing the jhanas as well. So that is really, in my opinion, that's the right attitude. Just practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Don't worry about whether jhana is required or not. And then see where that takes you. And eventually it will take you either to stream entry or it will take you to jhana in the alternative. So that, in my opinion, is the right way of looking at that particular issue here. So, there's also a second question from this same person. This question, are you okay? Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Okay, I'll just go on. It says here, I've listened to your talk on transcendental dependent origination. Dependent origination is a cycle. Where, in your opinion, can this cycle be broken? please explain if time permits. Okay, so one of the things that you will often hear is that the cycle is broken between the links of feeling and craving, between Vedana and Tanha. There is some truth to that, but I don't think that's the full truth. There's more to it than that. Now, how is it that the cycle is broken between feeling and craving? Well, firstly, it is broken because a big part of the meditation practice is the restraint of the senses, right? And that restraint of the senses means essentially that when feelings arise, whether they are good feelings or bad feelings, you try to avoid to have craving arise based on those feelings. So you feel something pleasant, and instead of allowing craving to arise, you know that that craving is going to lead to problems, it's going to lead to a lack of wisdom, it's going to lead to suffering. And because you understand the suffering inherent in allowing the craving to arise, you just let it go. You experience the feeling, but you don't actually allow the craving to arise based on that feeling. And this is what the suttas talk about when they talk about sense restraint. Sense restraint is based on the wisdom, the understanding that if you allow the desires and the thing just to run amok by themselves, you're going to suffer accordingly, and you're going to lose the wisdom that you already have. So this is the first sense in which there is a break between Vedana and Tanha, in the sense that you restrain yourself. And the ideal restraint, please always remember this, the ideal restraint is not restrained by force, it's not restrained by just, you know, gritting your teeth and clenching your fists. And you know what it says in the suttas? If you do all of that, you're just going to create more suffering for yourself. Because it's painful to grit your teeth. It's painful to use so much willpower. So always remember, it is about trying to use wisdom. Understand that this is dangerous, it will lead to your suffering, and then the sense restraint happens by itself. So that is the first part. This is the first way that you break the link between feeling, Vedana, and Tanha. And then when you do that, when you achieve that sense restraint, then mindfulness becomes strong. Yeah? When mindfulness becomes strong, then meditation starts to take off. That is when you're able to do anapanasati properly, or, you know, any kind of, or metta, or whatever meditation object you use. They can be done properly only when mindfulness is there, because it's mindfulness that allows you to direct your mind onto the meditation object. Then, once mindfulness is there, meditation starts to happen, and then eventually you reach a certain stage of samadhi. And at that point, as I was saying before, once you have samadhi, and this will usually mean the jhanas, perhaps not always, but it will usually mean the jhanas, that is when you have yatha buddha jnanadasana, right? So when you have yatha buddha jnanadasana, what does that mean? It means that you are undermining it. And you are, in a sense, destroying the very first factor of the dependent origination. The first factor is avijja, ignorance, right? Yatha bhuta jnanadasana is the opposite of avijja, the opposite of ignorance. So when you get to that point, you are undermining the ignorance, and in fact you are starting to destroy it. And that is what eventually leads to the complete separation, the complete break in the linkage between feeling and tanha. It is by undermining ignorance, that feeling and tanha are, that link is actually broken, and that it doesn't actually, you don't actually crave anymore based on feeling. So why is that? Because what you have understood is that all of these things are suffering here. You've understood that there is a problem here. You've also seen non-self. You know you cannot control those feelings. You cannot have things the way you want them to be. And you see the inherent suffering in these things. So when you see the inherent suffering, when you see the fact that you have no control, then you don't crave for these things anymore. It's a natural result. So it's really what you're doing is you are destroying the very first link, avijja, and by doing that, you are separating, or you are destroying the connection between feeling and craving. That's how it actually works. So the cycle, I would say, the cycle really is broken at avijja, at ignorance. That's why you break the cycle. And that causes the unbinding, if you like, between Vedana and Tanha. I hope that makes sense. It's a rather involved explanation, but I hope you can make some sense of that. Okay, I will move on to the next question. And this says here, when I do not meditate, when I am calm And when I listen to Dhamma or read a magazine or at the temple, most of the time I feel subtle and gross sensations. How can I deal with them, especially the gross sensations? Okay, this is a very difficult question for me to answer, because it's very hard for me to know exactly what is going on and what is happening there. It really depends on what actually is happening in this particular case. It depends on what sort of sensations these are. It depends on the mind state that is there while you have those sensations. Generally speaking, if the mind is clear, the mind is bright, the mind is not deluded, the mind is peaceful, you have a good sense of mindfulness, you feel good about yourself. If the mind is in a good state, basically, then these sensations are usually nothing to be concerned about. But if the mind is not in a good state, maybe you're feeling a bit confused or afraid, or there are lots of defilements present, the mind isn't clear, it is not peaceful, and you don't really feel good about yourself, then it can be a cause for concern that you're having these kind of sensations. So it really depends on the circumstances. It also depends on what kind of sensations there are. You know, there are certain sensations which just arise as a consequence of meditation practice, just arise in ordinary life. But if it's something very unusual, maybe it is some kind of medical condition. And if it is a medical condition, the best thing to do is probably to seek a doctor. But what I would suggest that you do is you find somebody who you know well, that you trust, that you can go and speak to, and you can speak in detail, not just have a superficial conversation like we're having now, but you can speak in detail, you can tell them about what's happening, and if you trust them, they will probably be able to give you some good advice. Maybe a monk somewhere, or maybe just another lay person, even a doctor, whoever it is, that is probably what you need to do, I would suggest. Okay, so I hope that that is helpful. So, so I will go on to the next question, and this is this says here, this is about the jhanas again, and about whether the jhanas are dangerous or whatever. So the first question here is, jhana is difficult to achieve, so the meditator can get disillusioned on the path, and. That's a very good point, and I appreciate that point. It's actually very, these things can happen. I've seen it happen to many people. They try very hard, and then they can't get there, and they get disillusioned. But please remember that jhana, think about arahantship, for example, if you want to become an arahant. We all have in the back of our minds that it would be nice to become an arahant. We want to move in that direction. But that doesn't mean that every time you sit down, you say to yourself, oh, I'm going to become an arahant today. I'm going to become an arahant in this meditation I'm doing right now. We don't think like that. It's more like the idea of becoming an arahant is something which is at the back of your mind. You say somewhere at the back of your mind, you know that this is the way you're heading, but you don't have a craving in the here and now. I will become an arahant now, today, this hour, or even tomorrow. It's something which is like a long-term aspiration. And the jhana should be the same thing. It's a bit like becoming an arahant. It should be something that you have in the back of your mind. I'm moving in this direction. But it's not something that you should aspire to every time you sit down to meditate. But I want to get the jhana today. I want to have it tomorrow or in the next 5 minutes or whatever. That's not the right way to look at it. So meditation practice should always be focused on just being happy in the present moment. Just being content with what you have right here, right now. Not focusing on the future, not focusing on what you want to attain later on. None of those things. Just contentment in the present moment. The problem always arises because we want things. We're trying to get things. And when we can't get them, then the disillusionment arises. So the best thing to do is forget about all of that. Instead of looking at the results, look at the causes. What is it that will eventually get you to arahantship? What is it that eventually will get you to jhana? What is it eventually that will get you to have good mindfulness? What is it that will get you to be more pure? And you know that the right thing is always, you have to practice sila virtue. Body and speech, of course, but also the mind. So you purify the mind. You do the metta practice. You learn to use your wisdom to the best of your ability to overcome the defilements of the mind, whether it's anger or desire, whatever it is. And if you do that in daily life, then when you sit down to do meditation practice, all you do is you say, I will be content right here and right now. I'm not going to do anything, just have contentment. And then when you sit down and you're content, and you're just feeling really peaceful and really nice, then suddenly you find the breath arising in your mind. And when your breath arises in your mind, you place your attention on that breath. Actually, you don't even have to place your attention there, because it happens by itself. And your attention is resting on the breath, and as your attention is resting on your breath, you gradually become nice and peaceful, even more so. And the path happens by itself. The path largely should happen by itself. We shouldn't try to have too much craving. So this is the problem. It's not just a problem with jhana, it's a problem with anything. If you try too hard, if you have too much craving for, even if it's just to be nice, even if it's just to be mindful, whatever it is, wherever you have craving, you will eventually get disillusioned because you realize you can't control these things all the time. So that is the way to overcome these things. One of the things I think which is the problems with the practice of jhana, which people often don't understand, is that jhanas are a very, very high attainment on the Buddhist path. And people don't often realize how high they actually are. When you read the suttas, the jhanas are always spoken of together with the Arya states. So you have the four stages of awakening, Sotapanna, Sovan, I think you call it in Sri Lanka, Sovan. You have the once returner, the non-returner, and the Arahant. And the jhanas are always talked about together with those four stages of awakening. They're talked about using the same language. These are the Uttari Manusadhamma, the superior human states. There are the Alang Arya Nanadasana Visesa, which is like the distinction in knowledge or vision worthy of the Aryas, of the Aryan people. They are the Sambodha Sukha, the happiness of enlightenment. So you can see here that the jhanas are very, very high states. And that is why they are at the very end of the Noble Eightfold Path. Because once you get to the jhanas, basically you have made it. You have done it. You have almost like finished the path. If you can get there and you can stabilize your practice of jhanas, well, basically you are home and dry, so to speak. Yeah? So you're doing very well there. So please, don't, if we aim too much for the jhanas, if we aim for something that is very high, of course, we may very well get disillusioned. So put it at the back of the mind, and just be content in the here and now, and allow things to develop all by themselves. So that was the first one. And the second one, a part of the same question is, if you are successful, there is a chance that you get reborn in the Arupa Loka and be there for eons, sometimes missing subsequent Buddha's teachings too. Okay. Yes, there is that chance, but if you don't do it, there's even greater chance you might get reborn as something much, much worse. So sometimes, if you can get reborn in the, not actually the Arupa Loka, it's actually the Rupa Loka, the form world, the Arupa Loka is even higher. Don't worry about that, because these are necessary stages of the path. These are things that you have to do. And if you get reborn in the Rupa Loka, so be it. Why? It's okay to have lots of happiness and bliss out and be happy. It's fine. You have no idea when the next Buddha comes around anyway. Maybe when you come out of that state, there will be a Buddha around. Maybe the way to miss the Buddha is to get reborn in a bad destination, in a very bad place. And then you really have a serious problem on your hands. So don't worry too much about that. Allow these things to develop. The most important thing is that samadhi is required on the path. You have to do these things. Don't think too much about, this is going to block me or hinder me. The Buddha said we should practice these things. The Buddha never said that you should not practice jhana because it might take you to the Rupa Loka. He never said that. This is just the kind of a modern or an idea that some people have had. The Buddha never had that idea. So if you're going to follow the teachings of the Buddha, I say, if you have the ability and you can do it, by all means, practice those jhana states. It's a wonderful thing to do, and it's very powerful, and it will take you all the way to awakening eventually. And this idea about missing the subsequent Buddha's teachings, subsequent Buddha, Buddha of the future, is just so unknown. It's such a big and certainty. Remember that in the suttas, the future Buddha, Maitreya, is mentioned only once, one single time in all the suttas. And I think that in the I'm not sure enough. I think that in the parallel sutta, which is found in the Chinese, I think he's not mentioned at all, though. But the fact that he's only mentioned once, it means that it is very, very uncertain what this actually means. It's very uncertain when it will happen. What we know is that we have the teachings now, we have Buddhism now, it's here now, it's Gautama Buddha, he is our teacher, he is the one we follow. Forget about the future Buddhas. It's too dangerous, it's too uncertain, we don't know what's going to happen. So now is the time to focus on the teachings of Gautama Buddha. Sometimes you hear about these big projects around the world, the big massive statues of the future Buddha, and I think we are worshipping like a pie in the sky. We're worshipping something which we don't know anything about. How can we worship something we don't know anything about? It's the Buddha, the Gautama, that we owe everything to. He is our teacher. He is the one we have the teachings from. So why are we worshipping some kind of unknown quantity that we have no idea when it will arise, or if we will be around at that particular time? So forget about the future Buddhas. Concentrate on the teaching right now. Otherwise, we will be led astray, led on the sidetrack, and not be able to practice the Dhamma properly. Okay, so the last part of this question, coming to that one now. Ascetics under whom the Buddha learned before he sat under the Bodhi tree were jhanic ascetics, but didn't bring the Bodhisattva the liberation he was looking for. Yeah, that is true. There is some uncertainty, I think, about this is a really bit of a side issue. There's some uncertainty whether those things that were taught by those ascetics, you're referring to Uddhaka Ramaputta, Alara Kalama, in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta and also in the Mahasanchika Sutta. And there's some uncertainty whether they actually were attaining the highest samadhi or not. But let's assume that they were. Now the reason why the Buddha did not attain liberation at that time was because he was practicing a system that was based on wrong view. Right? Remember that Uddhaka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama, they were specifically trying to get reborn in a realm that lasted for a long time, in a beautiful place where they could sort of, you know, hang out for, as you said before, eons and just have a good time. So they were actually after rebirth. And because the Buddha was practicing their system, because he had taken on board their view and the way they were looking at the world, that was why he wasn't able to progress to full awakening at that particular time. If the view is wrong, it doesn't matter if you have the right samadhi, because the view will corrupt the entire process and it will be impossible for you to attain awakening because the view is wrong. And you know that from places in the suttas, it always says that the Noble Eightfold Path and the gradual training always start out with right view is the first one. And if the view is wrong, the whole path which follows after that is also corrupted by the wrong view. So eventually, when you get to the jhanas even, if you have the idea that there is a God, there is a Brahma, there is a Supreme Being, whatever, then you will misinterpret, you will misunderstand what these things are. And it cannot lead to awakening because the view is wrong. So that is the problem in that particular case. And I think that is what is happening in that particular sutta, Majjhima 26, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, and also other parallel suttas, that the Buddha had wrong view at that time. That was also why he was practicing all the ascetic practices. Again, it specifically says in those suttas, the Buddha says himself specifically that I had wrong view at that time. And that's why I did all these things that weren't really useful and that couldn't possibly actually lead to awakening. I hope that answers your questions. Is there any follow-up or anything else you would like to ask? Go ahead.
Thank you very much, sir. There are a few questions arising based on this, where the individuals come and ask.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, it's okay. It's one of the great advice that the Buddha actually gave, in my opinion, is basically the idea that it doesn't matter. It's not so much what you do or how you do things. What is really important at the end of the day is where does it go? Where does it lead you? What are the results of that particular practice? That is what is really important. And this is one thing that he says in many different places, that if what you are doing leads to more mindfulness, it leads to more samadhi, it leads to more wholesome states, more kindness, more virtue, more compassion, more metta, as long as it leads to something good, then it's a good thing to do. Also, if it leads to a reduction in the bad states, you have less anger, you have less desire, you have less... in the unwholesome states? In the bad states, yes? So whatever bad states you have, if it leads to a reduction in the bad states, then that is also a good sign. That's a good thing. So this is what you can look out for. And you will find that you can go through a stage where you can use like an image, as you say, of Ayers Rock or whatever, which makes you feel peaceful, and that's fine. So use that as a kind of a temporary, as an in-between state, to take you from maybe a very coarse sensation to a more refined sensation. I know that there are lay people sometimes who, for example, they come back from work, and they are very exhausted, very tired, very stressed, maybe a little bit like you can be sometimes, and then they can sit down and listen to music. And then sometimes I've been asked the question, is it okay to listen to music? And yes, it's fine, as long as that music is a temporary phase, which just brings you down and calms you down and makes you more peaceful. You can listen to it for a while, and then once you feel peaceful, you can turn it off, and then you can do your meditation practice or whatever it is. So sometimes you have to, because you are starting on a level, it's natural in ordinary life, because there's so many things going on. It's very natural that, you know, the mind is quite coarse and there's many things happening. So it's okay and it's good to allow it to calm down through whatever technique that is available, whether that is, as you say, reflecting on the Ayers Rock or whatever it is. And then when that has done its job, then you move on and you continue with more refined objects, whether it's just the breath or whatever it is. It's like a stage you go through. Is that helpful?
Yes, just confirm what I felt was kind of correct in myself. So, yes, it sounds good, because that's exactly how I felt. Like, you know, after I did that for a while, then I felt much more connected. Good. And then I could go and do the breath.
Excellent. That's good. Yeah, that's the way to go. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
He's just checking whether anybody else wants to ask any questions. So he's just coming over.
Okay.